This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. There's a new biography of Lou Reed, and my guest is the author, Anthony DeCurtis. He's a contributing editor for Rolling Stone, where he's written for more than 35 years. DeCurtis knew Reed and considered him a friend, although not a close one. As part of his research, DeCurtis interviewed many people Reed knew, including his first two wives. Lou Reed co-founded the Velvet Underground, which he played with from 1964 to 1970. The band was initially managed by Andy Warhol and was part of Warhol's scene. While many bands of the time were singing about peace, love, and hallucinogenics, Lou Reed was writing songs about heroin, street hustlers, and transgressive sex. He continued in that direction as a solo artist, but he also wrote songs that had a spiritual quality. DeCurtis says, other than Bob Dylan, the Beatles, and James Brown, no one has exerted as great an influence on popular music as Reed has. Reed died of liver cancer 4 years ago at the age of 71. DeCurtis says that he wouldn't have written this book while Reed was alive. Quote, "This book does not at all times see Lou the way he wanted to see himself. Aspects of his sex life, his drug use, and his cruelty that he came to be embarrassed about are discussed here in detail, as are his generosity and his kindness, his talent, his vision, and his genius," unquote. Let's start with the song Heroin from the Velvet Underground's first album.
Just where I'm going, but I'm gonna try for the kingdom if I can, 'cause it makes me feel like I'm a man when I put a spike in.
That's Lou Reed and Anthony DeCurtis. Welcome to Fresh Air and congratulations on your new biography of Lou Reed.
Well, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So let's start with that song, which sums up so much about what made Lou Reed different from other music being made at that time. Give us your take on Heroin and how it fits into not only Lou Reed's career, but into the larger music of that time.
It's such a daring statement. You know, essentially it was recorded in 1965. It came out in 1967. And, you know, it was the height of the Summer of Love. There was a sense in which this was just a very different sense about what popular music could contain. I mean, Lou Reed's stated desire. I mean, he had studied with the poet Delmore Schwartz in college, and he really had this idea. It came out of the fact that Delmore hated rock lyrics. Lou loved rock and roll, and he loved poetry, and he thought to himself, you know, suppose we could make an album that someone like Delmore Schwartz would like the lyrics, and, you know, we can draw on people like Allen Ginsberg and William Burroughs. And that's what Heroin is. And it's also such a depiction of an addict and a kind of mindset. It's not necessarily the way an addict would articulate the experience, but it's a distillation of an almost unconscious or unexpressed experience that the drug heroin might have on a user. And it was, you know, I think the kind of issue that his music would always raise, which is, you know, can you descend into this underground, describe it, and not glamorize it?
But he kind of lived part-time in that underground.
He certainly
did. He used heroin, too.
He did use it.
Yeah, and he was the first person to inject John Cale, his bandmate, in the Velvets.
That is true. Yeah. I mean, all of that is true. Never really was his particular drug of choice. I mean, he always preferred amphetamine. He liked speedy drugs. But he did use heroin, and the song does come out of his own experience, which is, you know, I think another element of Lou's work. You know, it was grounded in his own life. He would make the point, and it's a point worth making, that, you know, he is not all the characters in these songs, but, you know, close enough.
You know, one of the things that's so fascinating about Lou Reed is that, okay, so this is one of the really early songs that he writes, Heroin. And at the time, he's working for Pickwick, writing songs to order. He's writing, like, knockoffs of, like, surf songs and songs about Detroit and California and a song called The Ostrich, which was supposed to be, like, a novelty dance song to start a novelty craze that never got started.
Exactly.
And before that, he was discovered at, like, a high school dance that he was playing with, like, an early high school band. And he was brought to Bob Shadd, a record producer who is also Judd Apatow's grandfather.
grandfather. I did not realize that.
Yeah. And Bob Shadd has him, like, record a few things, like, write and record a few things. And one of the songs, I really want to play this. One of the songs is called Merry-Go-Round. And so how old is Lou Reed when he records this?
Well, you know, he began recording really while he was in high school, you know, and he, you know, kind of continued to make records after that. But, you know, you could really see the kind of influences that he was working with at this point. I mean, in a certain sense, his work at Pickwick helped him because it was like working in a songwriting emergency room. You know, they would, you know, just kind of, okay, you know, surf music is happening. Let, you know, write 10 surf songs, or Lou loved doo-wop, you know, write a bunch of doo-wop songs, or write a bunch of songs about cars or songs about teenage love tragedy. And so Merry-Go-Round is kind of an expression of that period of his writing where it's identifiable as Lou Reed, but also you could hear him working through, you know, the various kinds of genres that he was kind of tasked to work with.
Yeah, so the guy who writes, like, Heroin and Waiting for the Man writes this lyric for Merry-Go-Round, I walk you home every day from school, but still you treat me like a fool. So
absolutely. You see, this is a very interesting thing about Lou. I mean, I think there were both those parts. I mean, people would ask me, you know, I knew him, and, you know, people would ask, you know, like, so, you know, if you run into Lou Reed, what does Lou Reed talk about? You know, we'd talk about, like, Leslie Gore, or we'd talk about Love Roller Coaster. You know, he loved pop music, and that was true at the same time as he also wasn't always doing that by any means. But he was taking pop elements, even, you know, on that first Velvet Underground record. If you listen to a track like, you know, There She Goes Again, you know, he lifts, you know, Marvin Gaye's Hitchhike for the riff. There's an element of loving what pop music is, and Lou's deep, passionate love of doo-wop and that kind of adolescent swept away on the wings of love. And it was a very essential emotion for him, and it remained that way.
So let's hear Merry-Go-Round, because you really hear Lou Reed's voice, but it hasn't quite become the Lou Reed that we know yet. And it's very, very pop. So let's hear him singing about walking her home from school. Here's Lou Reed.
I walk you home, yeah, every day from school, but still you treat me like I was a fool. Merry-go-round, whoa, you got me going upside down. You said you'd never date another boy, but still you treat me like I was a toy. Merry-go-round, whoa, you got me going upside down. You said that we would never part, but baby, you went and broke my heart. You wound me up and then you put me down. They're laughing at me all over town. Merry-go-round.
So that was Lou Reed before the Velvet Underground. When is he still in high school when he records that?
I think so, yeah. I think so.
Okay. I want to ask you about a period of Lou Reed's life that a lot of people have spoken about. I think he chose not to speak about it publicly. And I'm talking about the period where he had electroshock therapy, electroconvulsive therapy. This is when he was in college. And I had always heard that this was because his parents were afraid that he was gay. What did you learn about the electroshock therapy and why he had it?
Well, I think that Lou was acting out in a variety of ways. While he was in high school, you know, he was certainly using drugs, wild mood swings. You know, he definitely enjoyed getting under particularly his father's skin. And he also was acting out, like, you know, people would see his kind of gay life almost in performative terms. You know, he'd walk around and, you know, limp-wristed and, you know, shaking his hips and all this stuff in front of his father as a way to essentially aggravate him. But there were more serious problems with him, you know, certainly the drug use and the rebelliousness. The family was very conventional. And, you know, as a kind of, you know, middle or upper middle class Jewish family in the suburbs, you know, they went and consulted doctors about the kind of problems that they saw. And the doctors advised this, you know, electroconvulsive therapy, which Reed saw as a kind of torture. But one thing I learned from talking to his sister and other people who knew him well back then, you know, his parents really loved him. And his father, I mean, his mother felt guilty about the shock treatments for the rest of her life until she died. I think his father thought that he did the best he could. Lou was creating a lot of problems and he needed to address them somehow.
But you also write that once when Lou Reed came home from college, that he was basically like non-functional. And his parents were concerned that he was in a terribly deep depression. The doctor said, you know, he might have schizophrenia. Am I getting this right?
Yes.
And that also figured into the shock treatments. And his sister told you, oh, our parents were very liberal and they weren't homophobic. So it wasn't about their fear of him being gay. But I was thinking, like, everybody was homophobic then.
Well, that's right. And that's the thing. I don't think they were more homophobic than that. You know, they were just kind of a conventional suburban couple. Lou was bringing into their life everything that they were supposed to not have to deal with anymore after having left the city. There was a vision of the suburbs when they moved in the 1950s as this kind of Eden of peace. And, you know, Lou's various outrages, under which they would certainly have filed, you know, his going to gay bars and acting out as a gay person, you know, were elements of that. But it wasn't like, we're going to make him straight. You know, I just don't think that was part of it.
You're mentioning gay bars and him being gay, but he's also with a lot of girls at the time, right?
Well, yeah. It's an issue very much of the moment, interestingly, because I've kind of gone around the block.
You think he was kind of like fluid in his sexuality?
Yeah. I mean, one of his girlfriends describes him as inter. And that's a kind of interesting usage, I think. You know, there was part of Lou, I think, that was up for anything.
Mm-hmm.
But I've had gay friends write to me and say, you know, you describe, you know, this element of Lou, but he was really gay. And, you know, the day I got one of those, and it was, you know, it was a pretty stern email that, you know, made me think about what I had written. I had lunch with one of his former girlfriends. She was saying, look, there's no way Lou was gay. His sexuality was something I think, you know, as you gazed at it, you saw what you wanted to see, you know, and I think Lou was kind of open to going wherever that was.
And I don't think everybody had the language for it then.
Well, that's right. They didn't. That language didn't exist.
Yes, yeah, so
I just did want to say one thing about his parents, because, you know, when Lou left the Velvet Underground, he went back and lived with his family.
I was so surprised when I read that.
Oh, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, And I once said, you know, his first wife was talking about Lou being cheap. And she was saying, oh, God, you know, he never wanted to spend money. We were living in these all these small places. He would never ask his father for money. And at that point in my research, I took Lou's story as, you know, the truth. And I just said, well, would his father ever have given him money? And she said, of course he would have given him money. You know, it's anything for Lou. You know, he was the oldest son in this Jewish family. And, you know, his father was a very conventional man who would have loved to have a son that wanted to take over his accounting business. You know, he didn't get that. He couldn't get around, you know, a lot of what Lou's life and, you know, even his art was like. But on the other hand, whenever Lou needed anything, he was there.
You write about the women in Lou Reed's life, including his first serious girlfriend, Shelley Albin, his three wives, Betty Kronstadt, Sylvia Morales, Laurie Anderson, his trans girlfriend, Rachel. Was she a hustler?
Yeah, she was.
And so they were together for 3 years, and he dedicated his album Coney Island Baby to her. Her name was Rachel. What can you tell us about Rachel and her relationship with Lou Reed?
Well, that's a complicated story,
right?
It is an extremely complicated subject, and I'll try to distill it. You know, yeah. It. You know, he met Rachel in an after-hours bar and just really fell in love with her. And this was one of the revelations of the book to me. You know, I knew about Rachel. I mean, he wrote about her. So I was aware that she existed. But, you know, in my mind, you know, in a casual way, I just filed it, oh, Lou, he's wild. He'll do anything. But in fact, you know, there was a real depth to that relationship. They lived together. They entertained together. They went out together. It was bold. I mean, if a rock star of Lou's stature did that now, it would be, you know, regarded as shocking. And, you know, certainly in the 70s, you know, it was just kind of unheard of. But there was genuine affection there. And also, Rachel was kind of also a kind of road manager for Lou. It's a very interesting thing. It was a contemporary piece where a writer named Caroline Kuhn, a British writer, was writing about being with Lou and Rachel, and they were kind of arguing. Like, Lou was saying, what's going on here? Like, you're supposed to take care of me. Like, why am I taking care of you? And it was sort of playful, and it was a fight, and there was also a reality to it. You know, like, you're supposed to be arranging the cars to the venue, and you're supposed to be talking about what I need. Like, why am I looking after, you know, you and your problems? But Rachel had a secret life, you know. Rachel was out on the street.
So his album Street Hassle, you say that album basically ended the period of his life where he described himself as gay. What changed?
Well, one thing was the end of his relationship with Rachel, which was documented quite movingly in the song Street Hassle, a part called Slip Away, where he says, you know, she took the rings right off my fingers, and in an interview, you know, at that time, you know, said that was real. She did that. I mean, essentially, you know, saying like Rachel, you know, stole whatever jewelry was around and took off. And I think they had been falling apart. There's lots of theorizing about why that is. You know, some sense of Rachel wanting to make a transition, that she was taking hormones, whether Lou did or did not approve of that. But one thing that happened was Lou met Sylvia Morales, who became his second wife, and, you know, began moving more into that relationship. And, you know, over the course of 2 or 3 years, Lou got clean, got straight, and his gay life became something that, I mean, he's still honored in certain ways, a song like Halloween Parade or, you know, there would be references to it, but he would never speak of himself as gay after that.
No, so I want to play a different excerpt of Street Hassle, not the slip away part that you referred to.
Sure.
But the part that's about somebody overdosing. And the person narrating this story is like so cold, just so indifferent about it. It's almost upsetting to listen to, but it's
yep.
It's great music and it's great writing. So this is the middle part of Street Hassle. Do you want to say anything about this part?
Yeah. Lou was drawing on the story of a guy who used to be around the factory. He was found dead in the street and thought to be kind of that he was hit by a car. I mean, that was the official story. The unofficial story that was that he had died of a heroin overdose in somebody's apartment, and they had dragged him out onto the street and just left him by the docks, as if he had an accident of some kind. Lou turns that male character into a female character and then, you know, describes the guy who is the host of the party urging his guest to get this girl's body out of his apartment.
Let's hear it. This is Lou Reed.
You know, I'm glad that we met, man. It really was nice talking, and I really wish that there was a little more time to speak. But you know, it could be a hassle trying to explain myself to a police officer about how it was your old lady got herself stiffed. And it's not like we could help her. There was nothing no one could do. And if there was, man, you know I would have been the first. But when someone turns that blue, it's a universal truth, and you just know that will never again. That's really some bad that you came to our place with. But you ought to be more careful around the little girls. It's either the best or it's the worst. And since I don't have to choose, I guess I won't. And I know this ain't no way to treat a guest. But why don't you grab your old lady by the feet and just lay her out in the darkest street, and by morning she's just another hit and run. You know, some people got no choice, and they can never find a voice to talk with that they could even call their own. So the first thing that they see that allows them the right to be why they follow it, you know, it's called bad luck.
That's Lou Reed from Street Hassle, and my guest Anthony DeCurtis has written a new biography of Lou Reed. In the last years of his life, a fairly big chapter of the end of his life, Lou Reed became involved in Tibetan Buddhism, meditation, a form of Tai Chi. Did this coincide with him giving up drugs and alcohol?
Well, you know, the spiritual quest on Lou's part was something that really went back to the Velvet Underground. Lou told, you know, one person I interviewed that the song White Light, White Heat, which to the naked eye is about speed, he told this person that the white light part was about a certain type of vision or, you know, he always was trying different diets and different types of disciplines to get him, you know, kind of out of himself and maybe in connection to connect with something higher.
Mm-hmm.
Redemption maybe was one of the things he sought. So that was the latest manifestation of it. You know, I mean, I think even Heroin or a song like Heroin expresses that kind of spiritual yearning for transcendence. But, you know, once he did give up drugs, I think the Tai Chi and the Buddhism and all that stuff became, meditation became much more significant for him because he needed it more.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've been choosing all the music. Is there a song you'd like to end with?
Wow.
Yeah, that's an impossible choice.
There are so many. You know, I mean, let's, you know, it's a pretty intense interview. Let's end with rock and roll. You know, I mean, I feel like that is Lou's statement about the ability of this music to kind of help you transcend the circumstances that you're in and show you a larger world and save your life. And, you know, in certain ways, I mean, I feel my own life was saved by rock and roll. And Lou certainly felt that about himself. So I think that song might do.
Anthony DeCurtis, a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Oh, my God. The pleasure was entirely mine. Thank you.
Anthony DeCurtis is the author of the new book, Lou Reed, A Life.
When she was just 5 years old, there was nothing happening at all. Every time she puts on the radio, there was nothing going down at all. Not at all. Then one fine morning, she puts on a New York station. You know, she don't believe what she heard at all. She started shaking to that fine, fine music. You know, her life was saved by rock and roll. Despite all the amputations, you know you could just go out and dance to the rock and roll station. It was all right.
It's all right.
Hey, baby, you know it was all right.
It's all right.
Our film critic David Edelstein has a review of Greta Gerwig's new semi-autobiographical comedy, Lady Bird. She's best known for her work as an actress in such films as Frances Ha, Mistress America, and 20th Century Women. Lady Bird is set in California in the early 2000s. Saoirse Ronan plays the 17-year-old title character who's in a love-hate relationship with her mother, played by Laurie Metcalf. Here's David's review.
The title character in Lady Bird is a Sacramento high school senior who jettisons her real name, Christine McPherson, in favor of one that captures her fluttery exuberance and maybe suggests she'd like to fly away to the East, New York City, or Connecticut, or New Hampshire, where writers, she says in voiceover, live in the woods. I love that romantic invocation of J.D. Salinger. I don't know if writer-director Greta Gerwig kept a diary when she was 17, but the words sound like they're coming from a brilliant, naive teenager and not a somewhat patronizing older writer looking back. It helps that Gerwig's alter ego is played by the Irish-born actress Saoirse Ronan, who makes every line seem as if it's straight from her head. Ronan's accent is American, but her rhythm is Irish. She drives her lines home. Even when Lady Bird is theatrical, the artifice is emotionally pure. It's how this girl would style herself. Lady Bird feels she needs that new name because of an ongoing crisis of identity, exacerbated by her mother, Marion, played by Laurie Metcalf. Marion is coming apart under the strain of working more hours as a nurse after her husband, played by Tracy Letts, loses his job. She wants Lady Bird to go to a nearby state college, not a private one, partly because it's cheaper, and partly, it's suggested, because she's jealous of a daughter who can fly away when Marion can't. Their battles seem to arise out of nowhere. In the movie's first scene, mother and daughter weep together in the car over an audiobook of The Grapes of Wrath. And suddenly, Marion turns her anxiety and self-doubt onto Lady Bird, who actually throws herself out of the moving car. Later, they go shopping in a thrift store for a dress she'll wear to her wealthy boyfriend's house for Thanksgiving.
Did Danny say whether his grandmother has a formal Thanksgiving?
I don't know. There are a lot of kids, but she lives in the Fab 40s.
Oh, well, your dad and I went to a dinner party once in that neighborhood. The CEO of ISC, that was pretty formal. You're not going to a funeral.
Well, I don't know. What says rich people Thanksgiving?
I just think it's such a shame that you're spending your last Thanksgiving with a family you've never met instead of us. But I don't know. I guess you want it that way. Are you tired?
No.
Hey, Marion.
Hey, Joyce. Hey, how's the baby?
He's crawling.
No, I want to see a picture at checkout.
Okay.
So if you're tired, we can sit down.
I'm not tired.
Oh, okay. I just couldn't tell because you were dragging your feet. Well, I just couldn't tell.
Why didn't you just say pick up your feet?
I didn't know if you were tired.
You were being passive aggressive.
No, I
wasn't. You are so infuriating.
Please stop yelling.
I'm not yelling. Oh, it's
Honey,
perfect.
Do you love it?
You can hear in that scene the mother-daughter intimacy, as well as the way in which Marion gets so under Lady Bird's skin that the teen's anger seems out of proportion. As an actress, Gerwig's dithery mannerisms can make her seem too strenuously adorable, but as a writer and director, the balance between likability and toughness is perfect. Gerwig has the ability to skip along the surface of her alter ego's life and suddenly stop and go deep, quickly, without fuss. Then she skips forward again, evoking the tempo of a life lived whimsically, but over an emotional abyss. The supporting characters come on like caricatures, but each has a moment when you understand where their silly opinions or affectations come from and find yourself liking them. There's that rich boy, played by Lucas Hedges of Manchester by the Sea, who's struggling with his own identity, and a too-cool malcontent, played by Timothy Chalamet, who's remarkable in the gay love story coming out later this month, Call Me By Your Name. There's a scene in which a football coach, played by Bob Stevenson, takes over a production of The Tempest and blocks it out on the blackboard with some characters going one way in formation and others the opposite way, a one-idea gag that gets bigger and funnier as it goes along. Gerwig gives us just enough Laurie Metcalf to keep us wanting more. Even at the mother's most scalding, you sense the confusion of a woman whose resentment has spun away from her to the point where halting it could seem even more painful than giving it free rein. Lady Bird is light in tone, but packed with insight. The movie soars.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Coming up, Pete Souza tells us about his work as the chief official White House photographer during President Obama's two terms. Souza has a new book that collects photos from the Obama years and tells the stories behind them. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. During President Obama's 8 years in the White House, Pete Souza took nearly 2 million photos of him. Souza was Obama's chief White House photographer. But he actually started photographing Obama after Obama was elected to the U.S. Senate, and Souza was the Washington photographer for the Chicago Tribune. Souza shadowed Obama during his first year in the Senate, and then did a book of photos and texts called The Rise of Barack Obama. Now Souza has a new book, collecting White House photos and telling the stories behind them. It's called Obama, An Intimate Portrait. The pictures range from the famous photo of Obama, Hillary Clinton, and the national security team in the Situation Room watching the bin Laden raid play out, to a photo of the Obama's dog, Bo, climbing the stairs alone into Air Force One. Since Trump became president, Sousa has become famous for responding to things Trump says and does by posting photos on Instagram showing how Obama handled similar situations. Pete Sousa, welcome to Fresh Air. So I have to say, President Obama writes the intro for your book, and he says, over the course of 8 years in the White House, he probably spent more time with you than with anybody other than his family. Now, is that introduction hyperbole, or is that really true?
No, I think it's really true, and I think he's talking about in my presence. I was there all the time. I wasn't talking to him all the time, but I was always in every meeting and pretty much every situation that he had as president. So it's probably pretty true.
Were you trying to be invisible much of that time?
Yes. My goal was to document what was taking place, accurately capture the mood and emotion of the moment, and not change what was taking place. And by using what I call a small footprint, meaning not using a noisy camera, not using flash, moving around gingerly. I'm not sure if invisible is the right word, but I was certainly trying to be a piece of the woodwork.
So what were the ground rules that you established for yourself and that the White House established for you?
There really weren't any ground rules. It was a brief conversation at the start where Robert Gibbs, as his emissary, when he called to offer me the job on behalf of the president-elect, I said, I'm all in on this, but you have to be all in. I need to have access to everything. And the immediate response was, the president-elect gets it. And that was basically our ground rules, is access to everything.
So let me ask you about one of your most famous photos. And this is the photo of President Obama, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, and the National Security Team on May 2nd, 2011, watching a screen of I'm not sure what during the mission to take out bin Laden. And Hillary's hand is over her mouth. Everybody just looks incredibly tense and focused. What was happening in that moment? What were they looking at?
They were monitoring in real time the mission as it was unfolding. We were in that little conference room within the Situation Room for about 40 minutes, I think it was. And during that entire time, the mission was taking place in Pakistan. And they were just monitoring it in real time. You know, it's the thing that strikes me about that photograph now is you have the most powerful people in the federal government. You've got the president, the vice president, chairman of the Joint Chiefs, secretary of state, secretary of defense, and on and on and on. And they were essentially helpless. They had made their decision in the days and weeks before to launch this raid. But now it was up to those guys on the ground. And there's nothing they could do to affect the outcome, which I think helps depict why their faces are so anxious and tense, to just essentially watch as this happens right before their eyes.
So here's this, you know, really important mission that they're watching. As you say, at this point, they're out of control. There's nothing they can do. Where were you taking their photo?
So the Situation Room is actually comprised of three conference rooms. The president usually holds his meetings in the big conference room. The communications link that had been set up in Pakistan, Afghanistan, was set up in this little tiny conference room, which was across the hall from the main room. And they were worried that if they switched that link to the big conference room, they might lose the signal. So instead, everybody just kind of piled into that little conference room, and it just happened really fast. And the brigadier general that you see seated at the head of the table, when he saw the president of the United States walk in, he stood up to give him that chair. And President Obama looked at him and said, no, 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 you're running the show, because he was kind of the link to the folks in Afghanistan, Bill McRaven. President said, you stay there. I'm just going to pull up this little chair and sit next to you. So that's why the president is sitting where he is. And I had to make a decision when I first came in that room with this group. I had to pick one side because it was so tight in there that I couldn't really, once I picked a spot, I couldn't really move. I had to basically go left or right. I went left, just took a guess that would be a good spot to be. And throughout that 40 minutes, I probably could only move 12 inches at the most because it was just so jam-packed in that room. There's actually other people in the room that you don't see because they're like standing literally right next to me.
And it must have been on your mind to like not get in the way, to not interfere in any way in this really tense, important, dramatic moment.
Absolutely. I was using a very quiet shutter. So when I took a picture, it wasn't loud at all. There wasn't a lot, you know, usually in a situation room meeting, there's lots of conversation and it's easy to mask the sound of the camera. But in this particular 40 minutes, there was not a lot of conversation at all taking place. So I was being very quiet as best I could. And in those 40 minutes, I think I took about 95 or 100 pictures, which is not really a lot, you know, one every 30 seconds or so.
So here you have this like ultra secret mission. Everybody's in a part of the Situation Room. And you're the photographer and you're there. What kind of security clearance did you have and what kind of access did you have to all kinds of secrets?
I had a top security clearance, which, you know, enabled me to go into all these meetings. But I have to say that most of the top secret material is on paper, and I was not privy to paperwork. You know, I didn't get memos and things like that. And when you're a photographer in the room in these kinds of situations, you do hear conversations, but you got so many things to worry about, technically with the camera, and then hoping to capture the moment at just the right time, composition. You can get the sense of the conversation and the mood and the emotion, but like I couldn't tell you, you know, I couldn't repeat verbatim conversations that took place because I, quite frankly, wasn't necessarily listening to all the words, just trying to get the essence of what was taking place.
Mm-hmm. There's so many great photos that you took of President Obama holding hands with Michelle or kissing her or hugging her. And the president playing with Sasha and Malia in the snow in the White House. There's one where it's like Sasha's hiding behind a couch. I think it's in the Oval Office while the president's at his desk. So I know you selected these photos from over a million photos, but is that representative of what happened? I mean, was he able to spend a lot of time with his family? I don't know how presidents spend any time with their family.
I think it was important to him, especially when the girls were young, to make sure he was home for dinner every night. And even if there was something going on that called for his attention, he would still try to go home for dinner at 6:30. And if need be, come back to the Oval Office or the Situation Room after dinner and resume discussion. So I think family for him was extremely important. There's a picture in the book right in the midst of the BP oil spill, which, you know, if you remember, went on for weeks. And he had this meeting in the Oval Office about you know, trying to figure out how to get them to stop this leak. And as he finished up the meeting and he was walking back to the Resolute desk, he saw Malia out on the swing set, which was right outside the Oval Office. And he walked outside and sat on a swing next to her and spent just 5 minutes having a conversation with Malia about what was on Malia's mind. And it was only 5 minutes, but there was no BlackBerry in his hand. There was no AIDS in close proximity. He was all in for those 5 minutes with his daughter. And I saw that again and again. And I try to convey that part of his life in this book, the family coming in throughout the 8 years and how much they meant to him.
In your acknowledgments, you write, "Thanks to Malia and Sasha, I am so proud of how you always conducted yourself in the public eye." You watched those two girls grow up. I mean, 8 years is a long time in a child's life.
It is, and I actually, you know, I first photographed them when they were 3 and 6, so when he was senator in 2005 and I was working for the Chicago Tribune, I photographed them on his first day in the Senate. And as I said, I think Sasha was 3 and Malia was 6. And now, you know, towards the end of, I think, that last year, I think they were both taller than me. So I did watch them grow up.
What was your most stressful moment, if you can narrow it down to one or two, when you were the White House photographer?
I'll start out by saying that compared to what some photojournalists do, you had my friend Lindsay Addario on a while back, who puts herself into extremely dangerous situations to capture life on the edge of war zones. She's been kidnapped. Compared to that, my job was not stressful. I think the hard times for me were just the constant 24/7 aspect of this job and the physical toll that it takes on you, the emotional toll it takes on you in terms of your family life.
So you've said, like, you were basically on call 24/7. Were you ever awakened in the middle of the night with a call saying something big is happening, get over here so you could document it?
The one that comes to mind is there was a big tsunami, and I can't remember if it was Japan or Indonesia, and they had woken up the president, and then they go down their list and they call other people. They call me. And my question was always, is the president coming to the Oval Office or the Situation Room? And if the answer was no, then I'd go back to sleep. And I'd just come in early the next morning.
Mm-hmm.
Because of communication these days, phone, BlackBerry messages, and things like that, oftentimes the president would get these calls in the middle of the night, but it would be like a 5-minute call with the, you know, chief of staff or national security advisor. And there were probably only a couple times where he would, you know, actually come down to the office in the middle of the night.
So you've said that, you know, being a White House photographer is really a job for someone in their mid-30s or 40s, and you were 54 when you started.
Gosh, now the whole world's going to know.
Yeah. You watched Obama age. We all watched Obama age in office, as every president does. Do you feel like you aged more than the 8 years?
Maybe ask my wife. I did. You know, my hair didn't turn as gray as President Obama's, but like now I've got this this bald spot that's kind of up the top of my head, which kind of annoys me. But I guess that comes with as you age. So
I think you should just blame Obama for
it. No, I to be serious for a second. I mean, I try to. You know, one of the things that I admire about President Obama, and I'm somewhat jealous of, is he's a very disciplined person in terms of exercise and diet. And, you know, people say he aged. Well, that's mostly, you know, because his hair has kind of turned gray. But I bet he's probably in better shape today than he was in January 2009. And, you know, I took a page from that, and I did try to exercise regularly, try to eat right. You know, those things make a difference.
So after President Trump's inauguration, you were in the helicopter with President Obama and Michelle Obama as they left Washington because they were headed off to a vacation. You took a final shot of the president in the helicopter gazing over the White House as the helicopter flew over the White House. Then you landed someplace, I'm not sure where, and then I assume you said goodbye to the president and Michelle Obama. What was that moment like for you, that goodbye?
That was a very emotional flight. There was a few staff along for the ride. And I remember talking to my fellow staff members, saying how excited I was that I now only had one device. I had my personal iPhone, and I no longer had a BlackBerry. And that was that's how I cut the ties to the White House. That, to me, was the greatest thing to let go of, is that BlackBerry. And I remember walking down the aisle saying, I only have one device. And we flew to Palm Springs, and it was the one time where we encountered weather so severe that we couldn't land. And we made four or five or six attempts to land in Palm Springs, and we couldn't because of the fog. And that was a little unnerving, where the plane was going down and then it was quick going back up. And that happened several times. And we ended up landing at some military base like an hour away or something like that. And so it was because of that, it was sort of anticlimactic saying goodbye to them. Plus, it was not like a final goodbye. When I said my final goodbyes to President Reagan at the end of his administration, I didn't know if I would ever see him again because I was not that close to him personally. When I said goodbye to President Obama in Palm Springs, you know, I hugged both he and Michelle, but I knew that I would see them again. So it wasn't a final goodbye. It was like, you know, enjoy your vacation. There were a handful of us that then stayed on the plane, and we just flew right back to D.C. And dropped them off.
Pete Souza, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. This was an honor, really, to be here talking to you.
Pete Souza was President Obama's chief official White House photographer. His new book of photos and text is called Obama, An Intimate Portrait. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Mood Zaidi, Thea Chaloner, and Seth Kelly. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.